Hello, I'm Jay, an arts manager, educator, writer, musician, producer, and professional daydreamer.
You're so accomplished.
And I'm Miguel, a musician, arts administrator, educator, and lover of all things nerdy.
And this is Play Black, a podcast dedicated to nerddom, reviews, and hot takes on arts and culture and the human experience from the perspective of two melanated artists.
Just your typical anime bros, but with master's degrees.
And therapy. How are you?
Doing all right. Really excited because you know what we're getting into today.
What we got into today? What is up?
We are going into an in-depth discussion on X-Men episodes 1 through 4. And I think next week we're going to get into episodes 5 and 6. No 7 yet at that point, but it's going to be dope. We were hyping the series up the last time we had a Play Black, and it's just gotten better and better ever since. But real quick, what else are you checking out outside of X-Men?
Shogun has been insane the past few weeks, the past few episodes. You know, it's reminding me, I don't necessarily love the Game of Thrones comparisons, to be honest, because that centers white people and white nonsense. And for me, I'm just like, let these people tell a story that is specific to them without always attaching it to white people. Pero, the body count.
Well, hold on. Hey, yeah. I just finished episode 2.
I'm not going to say who. Yeah, I'm not going to say who.
Okay.
Yeah, no. Okay. But that part of Game of Thrones where people that you enjoy pass along, that does pop up here. And it's just like, no, I want them to live. So that part is annoying. But that's what I'm watching. And then what I'm reading, my own work. Last night we had the final group table read for 3 episodes. And the last actual table read is next week. I still have to write the last 2 episodes of the season. But those are going so well. And everyone's just so talented. So yeah, I feel like a lot of good art is what I've been inspired by. What about you? What are you watching?
I'm also watching Shogun. I watched episodes 1 and 2 and was just like blown away by the level of like care that has been taken with the series. Like I listened to the podcast, like the official podcast, and they were talking about how the just the subtitles went through like 9 different people to be accurate, which is really insane. And a huge feat. And it sounds like they were just really intentional with the series. Correct me if I'm wrong, it's supposed to be just 1 season, right?
I hope not. I could see that being the case. And I know that it's based on a book from what I understand, not a series. So that could also be true as well. But honestly, at the same time, I think it's one of those things where even if narratively it might be 1 season, the runaway success the show has been, I think it would take a lot of discipline and restraint to try to not to make it more and increase it. So we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I love like limited series. I think it's just, it's a movie over, you know, a certain amount of time. And that way, you know, whoever is the showrunner or the director or the writer or all 3 of those people have like a chance to have 1 singular vision for what is being presented versus the studio getting involved and changing seasons. I mean, that's how you kind of get into, I think, those Game of Thrones places when, you know, people just are there too long. So far what I've seen has been amazing, and it's been, you know, it kind of ties in with, did you watch Blue Eye Samurai?
Yeah.
Same period in Japan. And it's interesting to see like, a different take on, kind of foreign influences coming into the tiny island nation. You know, like,
it's never good though. The white people always up to some shit. So
turns out, colonialism is bad. You know, colonization not great. But speaking of all those heavy themes, I think it's time for us to just get into the Play Black.
Yeah, I want to set this up a little bit. So when Play Black first started, this is season 3, and season 1 our kind of goal was to be able to take our favorite pieces of media, these shows, and obviously react to them in the fun way. We used to call that the play black, but then kind of go a little bit deeper and explore the deeper themes. Mm-hmm. And we would call that the breakdown. We kind of stopped distinctifying between those things in season two. But a lot of our experience of X-Men has kind of been a beautiful celebration of both those pieces of just like being really fed as nerds and having these epic moments and boss ass things go down. While also exploring how X-Men has always kind of been the epitome, at least in comic book stories, of talking about a lot of social issues in those pieces. So today we kind of want to celebrate our roots and celebrate X-Men by peeling back. We don't even have to go that deep, but peeling back just the thinnest layer to be able to look at some of these deeper themes happening.
100%. So without further ado, let's get into the breakdown.
So first and foremost, obviously, this is going to have hella spoilers in it, okay? Like, we can't do a dive into a cup of water. We got to go in the whole pool, okay? So if you want to be a part of this cultural moment we're having, right, go watch this damn show. Go pause us right now. Log on to Disney Plus. Catch up. They just 30 minutes. And then come back and be fed, okay? So with that being said, take it away.
So we're going to do a synopsis and then we'll do like what we like about it. And then we'll get into some heavier themes. So episode one, Charles Xavier, presumed dead by most of the world.
Oh, no.
Is not actually dead. Maybe, who knows at this point, but he left the Earth to be healed because a man was about to die. Mm-hmm. In the old X-Men series. The X-Men continue to do their thing. They're like really partnered with the U.S. government, which is crazy. Or more like the United Nations. Jean Grey is pregnant, which is nuts. We kind of zero in on a mutant named Robert DaCosta, who gets kidnapped by the Friends of Humanity, which are like basically like red hat conservatives who are violent nowadays. They're outfitted with Sentinel tech, which is crazy. So, like, what's going on there? Team visits a Henry Peter Gyrich in prison, trying to figure out what's going on with the Sentinel tech by creator Bolivar Task. She has a crazy premonition in there. Doesn't exactly know what's going on.
Happening?
Yeah.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah. Right. Big foreshadows.
Did you notice that?
I didn't notice that, but we'll get there. She does find out where the Sentinels are coming from and where the Master Mold is, which is deep in the Sahara Desert. And then basically Scott, who has been feeling a lot of feelings about being the new leader of the X-Men, lays it down and, you know, goes in there with the old crew and basically just cap, like done. It's over. To the Master Mold and the X-Men. You know, it's a big team moment. Everyone feels really together. Oh, we really did it. And then they get back to the mansion.
We did it.
They play some basketball. And then Magneto shows up and is like, actually, Xavier left all.
I'm your new daddy.
Yeah, basically me daddy now. You, not my kids.
Right.
But you can stay, I guess. And that's the end of episode one. So, Jay. Big themes.
Yeah. There was so much to love about this episode because it had so much work to do. But at the same time, I think what I appreciated about it the most was it trusted its audience, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, they had five or six seasons of the show beforehand. And to try to recap every single thing is impossible. And so they trusted, like, you did your homework while also still making it an accessible entry point for everybody. So
yeah.
In the original series, Jubilee was the audience surrogate. This time it's Sunspot. And it's also a nice little passing of the torch for Jubilee to like level up and become, you know, more of her own individual while, again, looping us in that way. And I think, you know, we get to see how the team functions and their personalities by the drama of not having Xavier there. So, yes. You know, Cyclops being the stick up his ass a little bit, but having big feelings, and Wolverine loving. And there's a moment in episode 5 that affirms for me that Wolverine just loves drama because
he's kind of a catty bitch.
There was a moment where he could have taken it all the way, but he did clearly never wanted to. He just wanted to start shit. There's a lot of him being like a messy ass drama queen in the first episode, and I love him for it. And then he's assisted by the other messy ass drama queen, Morph, who is hilarious. So it was great. But it also speaks to like this more threat stuff. So that's the more fun parts. We obviously, and we talked about this last week, we get to see Storm be the full baddie that she is. Kind of getting into like the moments that are great now. There was some self-correcting in the show with making both Bishop and Storm's visual character designs dark-skinned. They darkened their skin to really reflect what they're supposed to be. So that was beautiful to see. But in really thinking about some of the more mature themes that came up here, I think we see a lot of these internalized phobias represented in Sunspot. So much of X-Men and the preaching that they do for each other and the space that they try to hold for each other is to celebrate and accept who they are.
Right.
And typically, the ones we see struggle with this the most are people like Rogue, where her power cuts her off from people to a degree, or people with very visible mutations. And so what's interesting about Sunspot is he has neither of those. And yet doesn't want to tap into his powers, doesn't want to claim his mutant stuff, doesn't want to explore it because he wants to be normal and he doesn't want to be rejected by his family. And I think a lot is talked about with X-Men as it relates to like the racial undertones of that story. But I think even more overtly now are the queer undertones to the story. And that internalized fear of rejection, hiding a part of yourself, feels much more aligned with that aspect of what queer folks struggle with. What were your thoughts on that? Does that ring true for you? All those pieces.
It does ring true for me. And I think it's interesting in like a specific race sort of way. Like, I believe Robert DaCosta is Brazilian. And, you know, part of the, you know, Latina community. And, you know, that community, first generation folks especially, hasn't been as embracing of the new acceptance of LGBTQ people and culture. Christianity is a huge part of that community. And you know, it's an interesting thing to observe that the Brazilian character is having a bit more trouble kind of navigating how he would even explain what's going on to his to his parents. And I think it's also a something about it rings true for me is of just privilege. Like, he's a rich person. He's a rich person. So he just like, he gets to just throw things under the rug and not have to deal with them. Yeah. But this is quite literally something that's like a part of him that he can't just throw away. So, I mean, he could, if he would, but because he can't. It's a huge source of just shame and guilt. And the guilt part is really interesting to me. It's like, I think we all have that with our island parents. It's like, you sacrificed so much for me to be here. I don't want to disappoint you. And it's awful that feeling like being yourself would be disappointing. But maybe I'm reading a bit much into it, but it was it hit home that way, that like being different, especially as a first generation person, different than, say, someone like Scott or Jean Grey.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I read it the same way too. And one thing I'm thinking about now that takes it a step further is, you know, if we're talking about this acceptance of queerness and all those pieces, I resonate a lot with his struggle. And I think what's also really interesting about it was how this internalized phobia he had extended beyond himself and led him to reject the people that were trying to welcome him. Right. And so, like, now it's just like, well, I can't be with you. I can't be safe here. I don't like want to get to know you. I don't want to be around you. Although he also does so clearly, because of his own feelings about himself. And so it's this really sad thing where you feel like you can't fully be yourself. And then there are spaces inviting you to fully be yourself, and you feel like you can't step into there either. And so it's like this echo chamber where you become more and more and more isolated, even as you're invited into spaces. And I wonder too, if he's internalized things about mutants, right? And what it means.
Oh, totally.
And like, because for a long time he grew up taking in the same stories, taking in the same cultural norms. And like, so it's all very messy, but I think the good thing is we're glad to see that he does come around in the end. Although I'm going to say this messy bitch Wolverine did not help. Just like, sir, this man is sensitive and is clearly going through something. Why are you flashing your claws at him? Calm down. That's not going to make him feel welcome. So
yeah, because Wolverine is obviously feeling some big feelings as well and lets them out in those little moments of rage, right? Other things I loved about this episode is just the showing off the budget. Like, the animation is freaking beautiful. I think one of the things that led to, like, our entire generation not really liking Scott is his portrayal in the live action films. And just like generally how he was perceived as just like lesser than Wolverine as an interesting character, or just the Boy Scout or the cop, you know, like,
right.
And letting him just like show off everything that he can do. Like really like show how he uses his concussive blasts to like move around was really interesting. How he uses it to like land from thousands of feet up on a plane is insane.
Yeah,
like,
right.
And showing his legitimate struggle. We get more of that darker side of him later in the series that like kind of rounds him out in a really beautiful way. So I think this is probably my favorite portrayal of Scott Summers, Cyclops, just in general.
Hard agree. And I want to say, there's been a lot of like fanfic on Twitter of the three of them as the throuple, and I'm just like, make it happen. You know what I mean? Like, let's stop beating around the bush. Just like, come on. Because I know that when Wolverine and Morph be doing some things that they be doing in the dark, Morph definitely be looking like Cyclops in there. Okay. I'm just like, all that resentment has to come from someplace. And I feel like y'all should just fuck.
I will
those
say
are my feelings on episode.
Morph becoming Jean and like fucking with Logan at that bar, I was like, dude, that's so mean.
That's what I'm saying.
That's like, but like
the two messy pairs.
They're quite interesting. How do you feel? You want to move on to episode two?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. So moving on to episode two. After that crazy ending, Magneto shows up, and everyone has big feelings about it. So while trying to like live up to Xavier's legacy, Magneto has started saving humans and mutants, and not just straight killing anti-mutant people. Everyone doesn't trust him because why should they? Because he's been their like greatest enemy forever. Rogue, plot twist, seems to have a sordid past. with the master of magnetism and is like, hey, let's give him a chance.
He really is daddy now. He really is daddy now.
Are you seeing that hair, bro? That hair is dope. Like, what? But the UN is not having it. The UN is like, he's a terrorist. Because he did kind of used to terrorize people. So when they actually offer him, in fairness, right? When they actually offer him a trial, he's like, bet, let's do it. So then they put this whole trial, put him in chains, which he could obviously break at any point. It's so symbolic. And have a trial at the UN. And a riot breaks out. These anti-mutant militias like pull some January 6th shit and start trying to
fully
stop the proceeding. While Magneto is giving what is probably one of my favorite speeches ever, to talking about oppression and his past as a former Holocaust survivor, or as a Holocaust survivor, and how it shaped his entire view of humanity. So while this is all happening, Jean goes into labor, which is insane. And there's a bit of a comedic moment where Logan is like, what's going on? And then drives Jean over to the hospital. Scott is like, y'all got this. I'm gonna go to the hospital. The doctor there won't actually
racism.
Yeah, straight racism. Like won't actually allow them to do the birth there because he's afraid that Jean's powers are gonna go crazy and you guys can't control your powers. All you know, just really blatant racism.
Which I just want to interject for a quick second. You would think then facilitating them through a structured environment and procedure would be safer than, I don't know what's going to happen with you, so just go over there someplace and have a baby without medical attention. That sounds safer. Like, you sound dumb. You sound dumb. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So back at the UN, with the riot is going crazy, there's this character named the Executioner who has a gun with the same tech as the collars that take away their powers. And he's going to try to take Magneto out with it, because Magneto is kind of like being seen as the leader of mutants with Charles being gone. Tries to shoot Magneto. Storm takes the hit and is depowered. Magneto then rips the whole roof off the place, brings the entire UN Council up into the air, and puts a handout and a gun to their head saying, like, do not make me be your enemy. I'm really trying to do well by you. I will drop you from hundreds of thousands of feet.
Don't make me let you down. Don't make me let you down.
Yeah. Eventually Rogue shows up at the hospital, who I didn't know she could just like take someone's like powers skills, not their powers. Takes the skills from the doctor, delivers their baby without any harm. And they name him Nathan. And then they all end up back at the X-Mansion. Magneto was acquitted of all charges and they're like, everything's cool. And then Beast informs everyone that Storm's powers are gone permanently. And she leaves the team with a really beautiful note to Jean. And then while discussing her decision, another Jean shows up and no one knows what's going on. And that's the end of episode 2.
And then that Jean faints. Yeah. So I think the two big things for me as it relates to the second episode were, one of the things that I actually found chilling was when Cyclops was fighting the Executioner. And he was saying, like, you know what I hate most about you people? Like, you complain, like, you have it so bad, like, the rest of us don't have anything. And what was so chilling about it to me is that I felt like could have been pulled from any Reddit post, any Instagram comment, any Twitter something, of just, like, how these insurrectionist-type white people feel. And it was so wild, the cognitive dissonance of like that character saying that thing, because these are people that you are literally hunting down, that you are literally trying to kill, that in the last episode you were kidnapping. And then you, on the other hand, want to say everybody has a tough, like you aren't actively trying to exterminate them. So like the delusion that radicalizes people to then do these crazy things coming up there was just so eerily reminiscent of how it happens in today's society that like, it was one of those things that hit a little bit too close to home for me.
Yeah.
And then I think you brought it up, and I didn't even think that deeply when I first saw it, of, and you mentioned earlier, the kind of January 6th of it all, where we're trying to have due process and like offer people to move through the system the way it's designed, and to have people then come in and disrupt that in the name of patriotism, in the name of freedom, in the name of like doing the right thing, when in reality they're butthurt, they're really trying to tear these systems down to work for them and their biases, and further create problems. So that was a little eerie for me.
It's very eerie, and it connects. I mean, the writing in the show has just been top notch. Like, especially these first two episodes, like the straight up dialogue has just been great. I mean, you brought up a quote that you wanted to bring up when we were talking off screen from episode one, that I think really fits in here, right? It's Storm talking to Henry Gyrick when they're in the in the prison
interrogation room.
And Storm says, "Your cruelty has only made humanity more sympathetic to our cause." And Gyrick says, "Oh, did it? No, you're in vogue, Storm, a fad. Look at my mutant friend. But under all that fashionable sympathy, normal people know the more room we make for your kind, the less we leave for ours. So we might wear tolerance on our sleeves, but we know the naked truth. Tolerance is extinction."
Oh, bars. Like, what?
Like, that is the mindset of someone who is just unwilling to coexist with anyone of any significant difference that presents any, that could present any threat. Not unlike any other person could present any other threat. It's insane. And to capture that into just a few sentences, into that sinister, or the interaction that you described between the executioner and Cyclops, the show is hitting on all cylinders. Magneto, like, not so subtly, but so subtly incorporating all of this Holocaust, you know, genocide language into what he's saying. Again, so topical right now. Like, it's all just like, these first two episodes were insane to me. I was like, whoa, you're actually going for it.
And you know what that quote just made me think about? It also makes me think about 2020, where we have this social uprising, right? And all of a sudden people are, white people are just like, oh my God, like y'all have it really bad. Like, this is crazy what y'all are going through. Like, police brutality is a thing. Like, we're going to stand for you. And all these companies make all these changes, and they're going to have all these DEI positions, and we're going to have all these reforms. Right. And then what a lot of us were worried about then was just like, there was this feeling like, is this a change? Like, is this country about to get better, or is this a fad? And unfortunately, 3-4 years in, we saw that it was a fad. It was a moment. And I think what happened in between that time was people in privilege, and white people in particular, began to realize that to actually make change, it involves decentering. That's not momentary. It's forever. It would be forever decentering them. It would be forever not allowing themselves to be at the pinnacle and at the top. And it requires sacrifice of privilege, sacrifice of money, of access, of power, of all those things. And they were just like, no, thank you. That's too much. And for me, this quote where it's just like, it's fashionable, but the more we leave room, it requires a lessening for us to be. And then you hear about things like the great replacement theory that a lot of these white supremacists throw around. And like, that is the thinking that in order for you to have, we must lack. And that is an existential threat now. We don't want to be a part of it. So crazy. However, to like bring this to a more positive side as well, the other thing that we saw in the second episode was change and redemption. We saw Magneto actively, because I think all of us were very wary, right, of the supposed transition that he was making.
Right.
But we watched him in real time be faced with an opportunity to justifiably be who he has always been and wreck some shit and destroy some lives. And we would go, we fucking get it. Especially over Storm, we would ride at dawn, okay? But for him in that moment, like, I was ready to throw some hands. But for him in that moment to really choose and acknowledge that the reason his friend left the X-Men to his care was because he saw an opportunity for Magneto to be better, to grow past his traumas, to try a different way. And he took that in and actively did so, I thought was beautiful. And I think we so often hold people to one version of who they are, and it's much easier for us to just always have them be that person. But to watch someone actually try to redeem themselves and try to change for the better, I think is a beautiful thing. And it tells us that it's possible for all of us.
100%. Yeah. I think, like Magneto's turn to good, even if it's temporary, it's genuine. He's legitimately trying a different route, which like, you know, these people out of fear, when I say these people, I mean, you know, half of the UN, all these rioters, like human society in general, they're not willing to move. They're not willing to compromise anything. And Magneto, who could literally flatten them with a wave of his hand, decides to take the higher road out of respect, but also just trying to make a change because what he's been doing hasn't been working.
Like, right.
It hasn't. And I think he is smart enough, and between the grief and change of Charles not being there, was able to get to that space where like, no, I'll try this. I'll try this here and see if it will actually create space for people like me.
Yeah. So then episode 3 comes along, and I just want to, I'm going to take a stab at just recapping this one, because the one word I have for it is it's cunty. Amen. And so really what happens is, and I don't even really use that word. I wonder if YouTube will take us down for that. Maybe I'll bleep it. But y'all know what I'm going to say. And so basically we have these two Jean Greys. And come to find out, one Jean Grey is not Jean Grey. Also, Beast and his bedside manner just really needs to work on that, because he really had the nerve in the first episode, second episode, be like, yeah, Aurora, these powers are going forever. I'm sorry, girl. And she's just like, what? And then in this episode, yeah, girl, you not Jean. You don't know who you is, but like you just like 3 seconds old. And I'm like, sir, have some decorum. So... fully rips that Band-Aid off of Jean's clone, we discover. And so what we realize, and this is where we get into the soap opera mess of it all, Scott ain't have no child with Jean. Scott had a whole child with Jean's clone, okay, who has all of her powers and a lot of her memories, but it's not her, has only been there for a little bit. And this is a plot by Mr. Sinister, who is trying to create some like super baby and wants to take the baby that they've made and run some experiments and basically taps into Jean Clone's rage, and she just becomes the Goblin Queen. I will say, I love this episode. It did suffer with that, like, we're not explaining anything, because why would she call herself the Goblin Queen? What does that mean? Why at the end she's like, call me Madeline Pryor? Where'd she pull that name from? You know what I mean? I'm just like, I would have loved some stuff around, like, why these choices? But she goes full telekinetic, telepathic witch, changes the house, manifests fears, and then runs away with the baby, and then they go after the baby, and there's a big old fight, and Jean Grey is just like, I'm gonna go beat her ass, and Beast is just like, sir, you can't walk, ma'am. She's like, I'm Jean Grey, I gotta go nowhere, and then, like, sends her mind to have a psychic fight, and boy, a psychic fight they have, and then she mollywops her inferior clone with kindness, right? Where she goes, I could end you, right? Because I was all of this. right. but we got to grow. We got to heal. And so it's like, okay, fine. And we're the same, right? And so they saved the baby, although now he got some kind of like technovirus type thing happening. And they come back and then Madness is like, I can't like be around y'all. I'm going to go find, I got to, what is it, right? It's this line from Empire. I got to do what's best for me, Lucius, whatever Cookie says. But she's just like, I'm out. I got to go find my own life. I got to find my own way. Call me Madeline Pryor. No reasons given. Goodbye. And that feels like, did I miss anything from episode 3?
No, I mean, here are little tidbits. Morph in the first season of the X-Men was kind of, died like the first or second episode. And then was like kind of,
he was taken,
taken in by Mr. Sinister, but like was like made it. It was basically tortured into being evil and mind controlled. So Morph has a past with Mr. Sinister. So Morph is the person that leads them to one of Sinister's labs. Bishop takes Nathan because...
Right, took the baby at the end of it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right, because the baby was going to die, but maybe they have something in the future that could help him out. So Scott has to give up his baby. And all this messiness, Madeline also has to give up the baby. And then right at the end of the episode, Storm is in a bar with a mohawk looking great and meets a old friend of Xavier's from X-Force named Forge, who claims he can restore her powers.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads us
to episode 4. Yeah, you got a
what? Well, I have to say, episodes 1 and 2 were so amazing. The pacing felt really great. Everything felt really like it was really running on all cylinders. This episode was the first time I was like, ooh, maybe, okay. This is...
It was burning through a lot of story. Yeah.
A lot of... Nothing was breathing. Like, we're just, okay.
Right.
Jean's a clone. Cool. We're just gonna run past that. We're gonna go straight into this Goblin Queen stuff. Mr. Sanders is back. Okay, cool. We're gonna go beat his ass. Great. Where'd he go? We don't know. It just kind of like went and with reckless abandon, and it did not feel very balanced. I loved everything I saw, but I had to like, okay, I've read some X-Men comics. Let me go look up what's going on. So I have context of what's happening. Once I did, I got it. But like that context needs to be given in some way, shape or form to just the people that are, listening, reading it.
Mm-hmm. And the reason I said cunty, by the way, is this devolution or evolution into evil that Jean clone Madeline had, for whatever reason, obviously came with a costume change, came with a new hairstyle, loved her black, obviously it looked like she was having some mascara and she was just like serving, right? And my favorite moment I would say in that episode is, you know, Magneto tried to get into a fight and she was just like, Sorcerer, you got the medal. I literally got everything. Okay. I'm not limited in the way that you are. So I got this. And I was like, I do love when the women kind of.
I really loved. Okay. Cause people shit on Magneto's new costume, you know, with the big M and like.
When it's a comics accurate costume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense for him not to have sleeves. Like he should have sleeves. Like he started getting like, maybe to protect himself. I don't know, because Jean was like throwing a bunch of shit at him and
none
like.
None of their outfits are for protection. Their outfits are for serving, Miguel.
Okay, because so you're saying
why would a Goblin Queen be going around in heels? It doesn't even matter because she's flying anyway. Like it don't matter.
You're right. You're right. I'm saying like Magneto seems to be like the most practically dressed. Generally, like his helmet is it's a helmet, but it also protects him from telepaths. Okay, that makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But no sleeves. Why no sleeves? You like you're getting all cut up for no goddamn reason.
Listen, the other one maybe needed dry cleaning. You've got to kind of do some rebranding. He is in a new era in his superhero-ness now. He's a superhero now. And maybe that means that he also needed something a little bit more cunty. So that's why he's just like, you know,
he's showing off the guns for a certain gloved
superhero. Maybe he's feeling himself.
How old is Magneto? in this context. Like, he
don't know.
He's a Holocaust survivor, right? So like he's in his in 97, he's in his like.
But then this is still the 90s, so.
And how old is Rogue? Do we know? Okay, like I have questions.
Well, no, that was addressed. That was addressed. People did talk about the grooming stuff, and they were like, no, Rogue was like in her 20-somethings or whatever, and he was in his whatever. So like she was an adult. Okay. Yeah, that was addressed. Because she looks also kind of ageless in this interpretation. You know what I mean? Like she could be like 19 or 30. Like I can't even really tell. So yeah. So then episode 4 happens. We get like a double hander. We get a little Jubilee storyline where her and Sunspot are bonding, playing some video games. Although he's like, I don't want to play video games. It's stupid. And then plays the video games. And immediately they both get taken. And I was like, see now, not bro was right because he didn't want to play with you. And kind of are surviving a challenge from, what's his name?
Motendo.
Not Motendo. That's really his name?
Mojo, sorry.
Sorry, I was like, that's a little on the nose. So Mojo, who's this alien who like basically, I think also has powers, but it's like people entertainment, watching whatever. And this is his new attempt to have some entertainment, is to put them in a video game. But they're getting through the video game. They're not necessarily doing that well because Sunspot still ain't trying to use his damn powers like an idiot. And it's like, okay, we know that everyone's on their own journey to acceptance, but so this is life or death. They have a mysterious benefactor, turns out is Jubilee herself. Mojo was planning the game for a while and made some copies of people, and her copy survived, became old, and it was wonderful because, I mean, Miguel will talk more about the themes in that episode, but basically, like, she grew, and then we see Jubilee do some really cool power stuff, and Jubilee's like, I could do that? She's like, yes, and that happens. And then her and Sunspot bone. And then, speaking of boning...
Like we can assume you're right. They're of age. It's fine.
They're young. They're of age. They're good looking people. They bone. And speaking of boning, Storm is now boning Forge, and that's a whole thing. And they're on a ranch. He's trying to help her, and she's just like, I still don't feel the wind. And he's like, it's okay. And he's just like, this is where he admits it. He's just like, actually, I feel really bad. And she's like, why are you trying to help me so much? Why are you going this far? He's just like, because it's my fault. She's like, wait, what you mean? And he's just like, well, I had, at one point I was just down real bad. And like, they asked me to design some stuff. So I did it. And she's like, wait a minute. You telling me, you sitting here to tell me right now out your mouth that you designed the shit that took my powers away. You, why I can't feel the wind anymore. That's you. And he was just like kind of. Like, I didn't make the weapons, like, that was outsourced, but, like, I am directly related to that, and I feel horrible. She's just like, you faggy, yo. How could you? And he's like, I'm sorry. And so, yeah, you tell me what I missed.
I think you got it. Like, okay, so Mojo, Mojo has, is like a dimension hopper, and has a dimension in which people can... are a dimension that is Rick and Morty's like commercial episode where like she's just constantly putting up entertainment into different universes, and this is one of those bits of entertainment. That's Mojo is like a classic Jubilee villain, which is cool. In the original series, one of her first like moments where she actually like gets to do shit is against Mojo, which is pretty cool. Forge. There seems to be a demon in the house at the end of the episode called Adversary.
A little supernatural. Yeah, a little it demonic.
It does. With some I also thought
very much like manifesting our darkness, yeah.
Yes. You said it's very life and death, and the second half of the episode is called Life Death, which I thought you did on purpose.
I didn't, but I think subconsciously I did, because I did know that they were called Life Death. So do you want to talk a little bit about the themes in Jubilee's story?
Yes.
What did you like in it?
I really liked, because Jubilee, when we first meet her, like you pointed out in the prior episodes, she is our POV character. She's how we are being introduced to the X-Men, what it's like to be a mutant and all those things, right? Mm-hmm. And now she's not that. She's established. Mm-hmm. She goes on missions. She's kind of mm-hmm. like graduated in a sense. And with that comes a lot of change. And she has a fear of change. There are moments when she's in the video game, which looked exactly like the video game I played at Chuck E. Cheese when I was a kid, which is pretty fucking cool.
Hilarious.
There are parts where she's in the video game where she just wants to keep playing, because it's her 18th birthday. And mm-hmm. leaving the game or trying to leave the game means actual life and challenges and unknowing. Yeah. And an adulthood, right. And she eventually gets to the point where she understands that you need discomfort to grow. And that's like a beautiful message for like a Saturday morning mm-hmm. cartoon thing. And it's a beautiful mm-hmm. message to us, the millennials who are now watching this as adults and are in very uncomfortable situations, and saw Jubilee as our surrogate as kids. Mm. So I think mm-hmm. it was a change of pace, because like everything's been pretty like heavy and kind of mystical and not very like light. And this is a Jubilee story that was fun, light, with something that is for our hearts to push us forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Love that. Nothing to add. I think you covered that. Yeah, that growth and discomfort piece. I think what's interesting for me with Storm's story is she's also in this very uncomfortable place where she is stripped of all that she's defined herself to be.
Yes.
And I think in her mind, she's like, she was a goddess, right? And her whole life was built around her mutation, around this goddessness that she feels, her connection to the elements, which then also, and she alluded to this in the letter, afforded her a connection to this family, to these people that she knew because of the shared thing that they had. And in stripping her of that connection to one thing, it really removed her connection to all of it, and really left her feeling like, who am I? And wanting to get back to who she was. And I think being able to open up to somebody and develop a relationship in the midst of that trauma and pain, and then find out that the person that you're kind of coming to for refuge and care as you're in crisis is directly or indirectly the cause of said crisis that's real tough. That's real hard. But at the same time, I think what this arc is building towards, and we saw a really beautiful example of that in the last episode, is like this exploration of reclamation of who you were, but also allowing yourself to be more. I feel like, as I mentioned last week, I was a little wary about this arc, not because I didn't feel like it was a good arc for her, but just more so in the context of like how we've seen Storm, just like how you were talking about Cyclops. We've had over decades depictions of Scott, and it was really nice to see that this adaptation was so self-aware of what Scott's representation had been and was really allowing us insight, and even the dynamic of the team. For example, I saw something today. A lot of people are happy about how Wolverine is not centered in this story, right? Like, this is not a Wolverine story. And totally. The creator was talking about, like, I wrote it this way specifically to prove to the studios that, like, we can tell an X-Men story, not have it be Wolverine. So again, these things aren't just existing on their own. They are very intentionally mindful and are often a response to what's been happening for the past 10, 20 years, right? And so for me, knowing that Storm has not really been allowed to shine in a lot of ways in the past 20 years.
Absolutely.
I was just really frustrated with that depowering moment. But when I went to go research more about that storyline, a lot of people were saying that this was allowing her the opportunity to really have her understand and develop a wholeness to herself, which obviously includes the goddess, but allows her to also be in touch with her humanity and the other aspects of who she is. And so we're not quite there in this episode yet. I still think that we're in the pain of it all. But I think a message and I'm adding a hopeful slant to it, is that when we are stripped away, as painful as it is, that also provides an opportunity for us to grow and to expand who we are and find a greater whole in who we've been. So, yeah.
Yeah. I love you hit it on the head. When we first saw these, when I first watched this episode, I was a bit confused as to why these two stories were paired. But after thinking about it for a little bit, like this aspects of growing outside of yourself and, being uncomfortable and being put in a position in which you, can either fold or take on the pressure and become a diamond, basically, it goes across both stories. And I think it was a really, strong episode. It left me wanting when I initially watched it, cause it didn't really like progress any of the stories too much. But it was still just super effective. A few things about Forge, cause he's a really interesting character. So Forge is a bunch of things. Forge is Native American, which I think we'll explore more in later episodes. Forge is differently abled. He has a hand and leg that he built for himself to use. And I think in the comics, I think he's a Vietnam vet. That's how he actually lost those limbs. And there's a quote that I want you to read, Jay, that you wanted me to pull from the episode. When Storm finds out that Forge is basically like the writer of her destruction in a way, that I want you to get into.
Yeah. You can read the actual quote, but what was really cool about it, and it was essentially on the lines of, along the lines of, Forge admits to Storm that like he is behind the tech that depowered her, and obviously her question is like, why? You're also a mutant, right? Like, why would you be a part of this thing that like harms us? And he says,
he says he basically he was down on his luck, and she says, you of all people should know the perils of trusting those in Washington.
One thing I saw going around on the net, was just like, this is why it's great to have interracial relationships depicted where the other person isn't white, was because there then becomes a shared language that minorities and people of color share that like opens them up to more experiences, right? And so to her, for her to have that, say that to him, it resounded in kind of all of the ways that you listed. You as a veteran should know better. You as an indigenous brown person in this country should know better. You as a mutant should know better. And none of that even has to be said so directly, because it's a mutual and shared understanding by these two minority disenfranchised people. And it was just a beautiful exploration of like what those relationships can look like and be. And I think added a lot of nuance, and also would be your own people sometimes. And, you know, talked a little bit about redemption and change. And so, you know, clearly he feels bad about it. But, you know, when you're op as one of your own people, that hurts. That hurts.
Yeah. That hurts. What we were saying before, sometimes the call is coming from inside the house.
It's coming from inside the house. Okay.
It's coming straight up from inside the house. Yeah, it's the series has been killing so far, and it's hitting on all cylinders. And you know, I think a lot of people might have thought if you read out what happens in the episodes to like test groups, some people would have been like, it's too woke, or it's DEI took the X-Men or whatever, right? But I think they're really striking a beautiful balance of like, this is what these stories are about, and
period.
It's also about powers, and it's also about cool comic book stuff, and it's also action and just stories about humanity, right? it doesn't, it's heavy because we care about these characters, not because we have a darker skinned Storm and Bishop, you know, like it is very powerful in that way. It just brings out the best of why comic books and fantasy characters are a great way for us to work through these dialogues and work through these issues, because it's separated enough that we can, we don't have to own it, but we can still see ourselves in these characters.
You know, it's allegory, right? What we're talking about is allegory. And I was talking with a friend of mine recently. He's also a writer. And we were talking about how sometimes when we're approaching our work, we get a little cerebral and we get tripped up because, like, there's the story on the page, there's the character arc that you're trying to have people walk through, but there's also, like, themes that you're trying to speak to. How do those themes come up? How are they represented? How do you deliver these messages? And it just makes me feel like I don't know very many stories that are just about Jack and Jill going to get some water. Like, whenever an author, and it's kind of, when I was teaching my voice students, I remember one problem that I had with them. I was just like, you all sound beautiful, but you sound dead. And you're just like singing notes on a page, but there is a lack of intention behind your performance. And it makes me think that you think that these scores are just written with just like, you sing this, then you sing this. Like, no, like when a composer is sitting down, they are thinking about the journey they want people to go on. They are painting. They are composing in a way that a writer is writing. And there's so much that goes into the construction of this work to be able to reach people, to speak to people, to facilitate an emotional reaction, to educate, to have them be in a different place and situation. And so when people keep saying like, oh, this story is woke, or oh, they adding these things, I'm just like, stories are always about something. Even when you read fairy tales, they're about something. And for you to just want to like shut your brain down and just go like, oh, look, pretty colors on the screen. It's stupid. It's stupid. It's dumb. And like, and I sometimes I feel like I'd be getting elitist when I rant about this, but like, it pisses me off. And I'm just like, more than any other story, like we said, X-Men has always been about this. This X-Men is not about people with powers struggling. X-Men is about a disenfranchised group of people trying to find community and acceptance in a world that does not want to accept them. And the thing that makes it unique is, instead of it being their skin color, instead of it being their body parts, instead of it being who they love, it just happens to be that they can make things move with their mind. But the lesson there is, if we can't even accept people for who they are when it's just moving things with their mind, maybe we should. And if we look around our world and ask ourselves, are there any parallels to what's happening there? Maybe we should be thinking about this. You know, maybe if we really care about the X-Men, we should be taking a look at the black people and the queer people. I just. So I don't want a soapbox. We've been talking a lot. It gets me to a place. Bring us home, Miguel.
Something I always tell my students is what you see on the page the music, or is it what you hear? It's what you hear. And what's being heard in your beautiful rant, as well as this the first four episodes of this show, is the story of humanity is messy, and it and people don't accept each other, but there will always be those that will try, and we progress because of those people. We are going to be hitting up episodes 5 and 6 next week. So with that, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of Play Black. Make sure to hit that subscribe button, leave a review. You can hit us up on Instagram at Play Black Podcast. Also hit up the YouTube, please. And yeah, we'll see you back here soon. Peace.